If you look closely at almost every major fantasy epic or like ancient creation myth, there's this unspoken contract between the storyteller and the audience.
Right, like a buffer of distance.
Exactly. It's this buffer. We're told these events happened, a long time ago, or in a galaxy far, far away, or in this pristine, untouched age of elves and magic.
Yeah, the cosmic battles, the dragons, they're all safely contained.
Like in a terrarium. We get to press our noses against the glass and just marvel at the world building, but we operate with this comforting knowledge that none of that magic is going to suddenly crash the window of our local grocery store.
It creates a sense of insulation, right? We categorize it neatly as pure fiction, which allows us to enjoy the grand stakes without feeling any immediate personal disruption. The boundaries are heavily policed.
But then you occasionally stumble into a narrative where that glass isn't just cracked, it is completely violently
Oh,
shattered.
yeah.
Where the grand cosmic terraforming of the universe bleeds directly into like a modern sterile hospital room. Or where regular Sunday church service is suddenly overtaken by a galaxy-ending spiritual war.
All at once, that safe distance, it's just stripped away.
Completely stripped away. You find yourself looking at a mythological landscape that is breathtakingly immediate. It overlaps our mundane reality so entirely that you start looking at the sky a little differently.
The term for that is narrative whiplash. And
Yeah.
when an author leans into it, it's usually either a total mess or brilliantly structured.
Right.
In the material we're looking at today, the boundaries between the spiritual realm and the physical world just dissolve.
Yeah.
We're left with a multidimensional reality where a sword fight in the heavens is happening at the exact same moment a baby takes its first breath on Earth.
Okay, let's unpack this because our mission today is pretty ambitious. For you, the listener who's craving a deep, intricately woven narrative that demands your full attention, this is going to be a fascinating ride.
It really is.
We are diving into a mythic text by an author named Topi Hulttu. Our sources are a stack of excerpts from a work titled simply Teksti.
Which means text in Finnish, right?
Right. And this includes interconnected segments with these incredibly evocative titles like The Legend of Toivo and Elisa, The Green Gems, Fantasy World Part 1, and The Vision of the Roses and the Heavenly Wedding.
What Hulttu has constructed here is honestly a chimera of a text. It effortlessly blends the massive scale of cosmic creation mythology with the high-stakes heroics of high fantasy.
Complete with knights and glowing swords.
Exactly, and it underpins all of it with profound, heavy spiritual theology. It operates as a single, cohesive epic.
And these sources operate on multiple scales simultaneously. We're going to zoom all the way out to the architectural drafting of the universe, and then we're going to push the lens all the way in with microscopic precision to the birth of two specific
The
individuals.
micro and the macro.
Right. Just to set the ground rules for you listening, though, while this text contains heavy religious, theological, and apocalyptic imagery, our objective is purely analytical.
We're treating this lore as the factual foundation of the story provided in the sources.
Yes. We aren't taking theological sides or debating the real-world religion it draws from. We are here to explore the brilliant allegorical world-building and the structural mechanics of Hulttu's universe.
What's fascinating here is how the text uses sensory detail as a load-bearing pillar for that architecture. Right from the very first sentence, color isn't just descriptive, it's structural.
Like physical forces.
Exactly. Specifically, the colors green and white act as physical forces. The author pairs these colors with massive elemental forces, fire, water, thunder, to build a deeply symbolic, functioning universe.
And our roadmap for today is chronological, right?
Yep. We'll start in the cosmic before, move through the literal terraforming of Earth, witness the devastating structural corruption of a celestial guardian, transition into the earthly births of two prophesied figures, and ultimately arrive at a visionary, deeply literal, heavenly wedding.
It's the ultimate zero to infinity timeline. So let's jump to the absolute zero point. The deep dive begins in a space before space. The creator acts.
But the inciting incident isn't a massive explosion.
Right, it's not a big bang.
No, and it isn't an echoing spoken word in a dark void either. It starts with a breath. The creator breathes into existence visible, glowing emerald stones.
And those stones are the cornerstone of the entire mythology. The text explicitly describes them as glowing with a green brilliance.
And it goes further to define this specific shade of green as the color of life that directly reflects the creator's essence. These emeralds aren't just pretty rocks, they serve as the literal green foundation for paradise.
Let me stop right there because my mind is already snagging on this detail. If you look at the pantheon of creation myths, we usually start with nothingness, right?
A black watery void, usually.
Yeah, a void, and then a blinding white light that cuts through it. Here, we start with jewelry, with hard gemstones.
It completely subverts the standard organic first trope. If we break down the significance of starting a creation myth with stones and the color green, we uncover something brilliant.
Because green usually means plants, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Green universally signifies vitality, flora, organic growth, spring, breathing lungs. Mm-hmm. But here, before a single blade of grass exists, before the concept of biology has even been drafted, that essence of life is crystallized into a hard, eternal, inorganic foundation.
Wow.
Right. An emerald doesn't wither in the autumn. It doesn't rot or decay. It holds the fragile, fleeting concept of life in an unbreakable, eternal state of preservation.
It's almost like the creator is laying down the universe's motherboard. But instead of cold, dead silicon chips waiting to process data, the circuitry of reality is constructed out of these infinitely powerful, glowing, green batteries of pure, unadulterated life force.
Batteries of life force captures the mechanic perfectly. Silicon implies computation, but these emeralds imply living memory. They hold the predetermined blueprint for all future existence.
And the text explicitly notes that the creator places a light inside these emeralds that reflects his spirit's eternal plan.
From this light, a massive green arc is made to shine above paradise, symbolizing a covenant, like a promise, for all future life. The physical universe that comes later is simply a projection of the data stored in that emerald forest.
But, you know, a glowing vault holding the blueprints of existence requires a serious security detail. So the creator breathes again, the emeralds glow brighter, and the celestial staff is drafted into existence.
By angels.
Right. First, a giant guardian angel is molded specifically to watch over this emerald forest. But here is the massive red flag in the system. The text states the creator places into this guardian angel a created soul with its own free will.
Yeah, that's a huge detail.
We also get a fire angel burning not just with regular orange flames, but with specific green, blue, orange, and red fire created specifically to defend life. And finally, bright white-clad singer angels are brought in to provide the soundtrack of paradise.
The division of celestial labor is incredibly specific. You have the guardian standing watch, the defender armed with the elemental spectrum of creation represented by those four distinct flame colors, and the worshipers.
But I really have to push back on the creator's architectural logic here.
Okay, let's hear it.
If I've just built a perfect, eternal, unbreakable vault of glowing emeralds that hold the literal blueprint for all future life, the absolute last thing I am doing is giving the primary security guard free will.
It seems like a massive flaw.
It's not just a glitch. It's a catastrophic vulnerability deliberately written into a perfect system. It feels like leaving the keys to the nuclear launch codes on the dashboard of an unlocked car in a bad neighborhood. Why introduce chaos into a closed, perfect loop?
From a purely utilitarian risk management perspective, it seems entirely reckless. But this forces us to engage with the core theological and philosophical engine operating within Holtu's text, the absolute necessity of free will for the existence of genuine love and genuine worship.
Because forced worship isn't worship.
Exactly. If the guardian or any subsequent creation is simply programmed to protect, to obey, and to sing praises, then their obedience is functionally meaningless. It's just code executing itself.
Right.
For the color of life to actually mean anything for life to have value over man, the beings experiencing it must have the autonomy to choose it. And autonomy to choose inherently and permanently requires the autonomy to reject.
You can't actually have a meaningful concept of light if you haven't permitted the possibility of a shadow.
Precisely. A programmed robot saying, "I love you," carries no weight. The creator is willing to risk the structural integrity of the universe because a forced utopia is just a prison painted green.
A prison painted green. That's a great way to put it.
And the text gives us a massive flashing neon sign that the creator knows exactly what he's doing despite these massive risks. We have to look closely at the song that the white-clad singer angels are given to sing in these first moments.
Right, the very first song.
Yeah. The song declares the creator as the highest. It praises the glowing green stones, but then it drops this incredibly specific prophetic line. It says, "Thus begins the story of the bright, white-hearted, pure children of the creator of that living, green-eyed bride."
I remember reading that line and having to read it like three times. They are singing about a living, green-eyed bride In the absolute first moments of cosmic existence.
There's no Earth yet.
There is no Earth. There is no humanity. There are no eyes to be green yet. It is pure, unadulterated foreshadowing encoded into the universe's original boot-up sequence.
It acts as an anchor for the reader. It tells us that the ultimate endgame of this entire universe, the arrival of this bride, is already a fixed point in the creator's timeline.
So no matter what happens.
Exactly. Whatever happens with this free-willed guardian angel, whatever chaos or rebellion ensues, the arrival of this green-eyed bride isn't just a possibility, it's a guaranteed destination.
So we have the cosmic blueprint locked in, the emerald motherboard is humming, the angels are singing a prophetic track, and the guardian is at his post with his terrifyingly free will.
And from the state of celestial tension, the text shifts gears.
The creator looks at paradise and decides to make a mirror image of it. He decrees, "Let there be an earth that reflects paradise." And we transition from cosmic blueprints into the gritty physical architecture of our world.
And the sequence of this earthly terraforming is incredibly granular. It doesn't just wave a magic wand. The text states that the empty space of the universe is made with the elements of the earth.
Physical elements.
Yeah. The stones of life, those original emeralds, reflect their green light down into the formless, chaotic world. And that light literally, physically shapes it. Then comes the division of the waters and the creation of an ocean of oxygen.
I am obsessed with that phrase, ocean of oxygen.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It takes a completely modern hard science concept, the specific atmospheric gas composition required for biology to function, and wraps it in this gorgeous, poetic, mythic language. It's not just an empty sky. It's an invisible, breathable, churning ocean that we're all walking around at the bottom of.
It's a brilliant synthesis. Ancient creation myths usually treat the sky as a solid dome, like a firmament holding back waters above. Haltu updates the mythology with modern chemistry, but retains the awe.
Yeah, it feels ancient and sci-fi at the same time.
Exactly. After this ocean of oxygen is formed, the creator stretches an arc of clouds over the primordial sea, raises the earth's rocky crust from the depths, and fills the surface with flora, flowers, plants, fruit-bearing trees.
That original green light from the emeralds is finally taking on a physical, organic form. And once the stage is set, the text turns its gaze upward again. The creator fills the heavens with planets and burning, twinkling stars.
But again, the vocabulary is so deliberate here.
Yes. The text calls the stars the candles of the universe. A star isn't a massive, terrifying ball of nuclear fusion happening millions of light years away. It's a candle.
It implies a room.
Right, a domestic space that has been carefully lit for an inhabitant.
It radically scales down the incomprehensible, cold vastness of space into something intimate and cared for. And this intimate care extends directly into the animal kingdom.
Oh, the animals are great.
The text lists the fauna, but gives each a specific joyous verb. The whale is created to sing, the dolphin to leap, the fish to school, the birds to fly free, and the earth creatures to crawl and frolic.
But all of this, the breathable ocean of oxygen, the flora, the candles in the sky, the singing whales, it's all just setting the table.
Setting the stage.
The text announces, and finally the crown of that creation from the dust of the earth. Humanity is brought online, but Haltu gives a deeply specific reason for humanity's creation. We aren't just made to wander around and tend the garden.
No, we're explicitly made for the sake of a spouse's heart to share paradise.
Which is such a shift.
It represents a massive philosophical pivot in world building. In many ancient myths, humanity is created to do the grunt work for the gods, you know, to provide sacrifices or to serve as entertainment.
Like we're just celestial janitors.
Right. Here, humanity, the crown of creation, is made for partnership. A spouse's heart implies equality of experience, if not power. The purpose is shared existence, to care for the creation, to worship freely, and to share in the joy of the Emerald Foundation.
It elevates the human role from biological inhabitant to cosmic partner. But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly a little ominous.
The tension comes back.
Yeah. All of this beautiful, peaceful creation is taking place. The earth is blooming. Humanity is formed. The dolphins are leaping. But the text inserts this sharp, jagged detail. The angels are surrounding a fiery, radiant throne, which the creator formed to reflect his eternal power over his creations.
The throne is such a stark contrast.
I am stuck on this throne. If you've just built a perfect, peaceful earth, specifically designed as a serene theater for a spouse to share joy, why do you need a fiery, radiant throne representing eternal power? A fiery throne is an implement of dominance. It projects intimidation.
It does.
Doesn't the very existence of a weaponized throne imply that a threat to that power already exists within the system?
You're hitting on the core tension of the narrative. The presence of a fiery throne in the middle of a supposed utopia is a massive structural clue.
Mm.
It signals to the reader that authority must be actively maintained, not just passively assumed.
So the threat is real.
Very real. But the threat doesn't come from the newly formed Earth or the leaping dolphins or the human partners. The threat is gestating at the very top of the celestial hierarchy. It comes from the very guardian tasked with protecting the Emerald Foundation.
The virus we talked about, the free will given to the security guard, is mutating.
Exactly that. While the Earth is being lovingly formed, a dark pride ignites in the heart of the guardian angel. The text suddenly shifts its terminology, referring to him as that distortion of the universe.
Wow, distortion of the universe.
He looks at that fiery throne, the very symbol of authority you pointed out, and thinks, I will sit on the throne of that creator and rule the crown of creation.
It's the ultimate hubris. But the mechanics of how the text describes the fall are what really grabbed me. When the guardian rebels, the text says that one of the stones of paradise went dark.
The Emerald motherboard literally short circuits. A node dies.
And that darkening stone exerts a gravitational pull, dragging a third of the singer angels down with the guardian's rebellion.
The physics of this rebellion are fascinating to track. The guardian isn't simply told to leave. The creator, seeing this distortion, seals the guardian inside a black stone.
Inside the stone?
Yes. Consider the structural poetry of that. The universe began with the creator breathing light into green stones of life. The ultimate antagonist is now sealed inside a lightless black stone. It's an anti-emerald, a corrupted dead hard drive meant to contrast the living batteries of paradise.
And this black stone is hurled like a bolt of lightning into the expanses of the newly created Earth. But he's not just left there to roam freely, right?
Oh, no, he's bound.
The fire angel, the one armed with the green, blue, orange, and red flames of creation, temporarily binds that black stone in the realms of the air with burning, fiery chains.
So we have a contained, furious, chained evil hovering in the very atmosphere of the Earth.
But this raises the biggest theological question of the text so far. When the creator seals him, the creator issues a very specific decree to the fallen guardian.
The decree is wild.
He says, even you, evil, I will use to brighten the white hearts, for I know that because of you, they too will fall. I need us to unpack the logic there because it sounds dangerously close to the creator allowing the corruption of his brand new human partners on purpose.
It is the ultimate theological paradox of the epic. Even you, evil, I will use to brighten the white hearts. The creator is openly acknowledging that the black stone, even while chained, will emit enough corruption to cause the crown of creation to fall.
So he knows humanity will be infected.
He knows they will be infected by this proximity to evil, but rather than panic, he declares that this very evil will be repurposed as a tool for ultimate purification.
It's like
the white hearts of humanity will eventually shine brighter because they had to endure, fight, and overcome the darkness.
It's like the creator is practicing a cosmic form of judo.
Judo, yes.
The guardian angel uses his massive weight and free will to strike out in rebellion. The creator doesn't meet force with force to just vaporize him. He steps aside, uses that exact momentum of the rebellion, and redirects it to achieve a more profound victory down the line, the brightening of the white hearts.
Cosmic judo is a perfect analogy. Evil is contained in the black stone, shackled by the fire angel, but it is temporarily permitted to act within the system as a crucible for humanity, a stress test for the free will of the spouse.
But he doesn't just leave them hanging.
No, the creator doesn't abandon humanity to this crucible without a lifeline. In that exact same breath, he issues a promise to the black stone. But I will save my chosen ones for the sake of my name. I will send my son to crush your head, you black serpent.
And with that one sentence, the entire genre of the story shifts. We go from a high concept tragedy of a fallen angel in the heavens to the epic setup for a gritty, physical, boots on the ground battle on the earthly plane.
The black stone is identified as a serpent, and its head will be crushed.
But a cosmic war requires physical champions in the dirt. The earth has been infected, and the antidote has to be born into that same dirt, which leads to an incredible jarring shift in the text's focus.
Talk about whiplash.
Right. We leave the celestial expanse, the glowing emeralds, the fiery chains, and we zoom in hard on a location you would never expect, a White Pearl Hospital.
If you're listening and feeling a bit of mythological whiplash right now, that is entirely by design. We've been swimming in the deep end of cosmic creation, and suddenly we're standing in a modern hospital ward.
In Finland.
Right. But Halt 2 overlays the mythic elements onto the modern setting flawlessly. Thunder is violently rumbling outside this hospital as a baby boy named Toivo is born. The text specifically notes his mother smiles, an angel smile.
It's so cinematic. And while this helpless baby is crying in a sterile hospital room, the text cross-cuts back to heaven. We see what amounts to a divine war council.
The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, they're conversing, actively planning this infant's future. They state, I will create a spouse for him, and when they are one, they are my two sackcloth-clad witnesses, my strongest warriors.
I'd argue there's more world-building packed into that single line than in most entire chapters. First, it establishes that Toivo is not just a random child caught in a cosmic crossfire. He's a drafted soldier, incarnated specifically to be a weapon against the Black Stone.
And his power isn't unlocked yet.
Exactly. Second, his ultimate power is locked behind a condition: it won't be realized alone. It requires a spouse. It requires union. And third, and most importantly, they are designated as sackcloth-clad witnesses.
Let's translate that term for a second for anyone who doesn't know, because sackcloth isn't exactly standard fantasy armor. You usually have chosen ones in shining mithril or glowing cloaks.
Not goat hair.
Right. Sackcloth is a coarse, scratchy material made of goat's hair. In ancient traditions, it is the garment of extreme public mourning, of desperate repentance, and of prophets delivering harsh truths.
It's meant to be uncomfortable.
To call your strongest warriors sackcloth clad implies that their earthly mission is not going to be glorious parades and easy victories. It guarantees that their mission involves immense suffering and grief.
It completely subverts the glorious chosen one trope. Their strength is intrinsically linked to their capacity to suffer and bear witness to the pain of the world. And the text immediately underscores how multidimensional Toivo's birth truly is in a segment titled Fantasy World Part 1.
Oh, this part is amazing.
Here we see the spiritual reality of what is happening in that hospital room. In this fantasy overlay, there are knights praying in a pulsating white pearl-shaped temple. They're leaning heavily on the white hilts of their swords as the sky above them crackles with violent, beautiful patterns in the clouds.
And Toivo is born.
Toivo is born with a scream, and white midwives hand him to a white queen.
The blurring of reality here is just masterful. The White Pearl Hospital of the physical world is simultaneously a pulsating white pearl-shaped temple in the spiritual realm.
Two things happening at once.
Yeah. The doctors or nurses are the white midwives, and the mother with the angel smile is literally the white queen. It forces you, as the reader, to reconsider the mundane. It suggests that every physical event has a massive, high fantasy's spiritual counterpart occurring right on top of it.
It's a synchronized magic system. And in this temple, the white queen looks at baby Toivo, who is radiating light, and declares his title. You are the son of thunder and an instrument of hope for this dark world.
Instrument of hope, which is a brilliant linguistic Easter egg, since the name Toivo literally translates to the word hope in Finnish.
Which is a lovely detail.
So we have our first warrior on the board, the son of thunder, but the Divine War Council said there would be two sackcloth witnesses, and we don't get the second one right away. There is a massive 10-year gap in the narrative.
Yes, a decade later.
Exactly 10 years later, in a completely different setting, the spouse is born.
In the bright spring sun, a great and most beautiful miracle is born. Her name is Elisa, and her birth setting couldn't be more diametrically opposed to Toivo's crackling, thunderous, sword-leaning temple.
Right.
She's born above the roaring Seven Sisters waterfall in Geiranger, Norway. The text strips away the militaristic imagery and describes her simply but powerfully as a white living rose.
I am stuck on this 10-year gap. We have Toivo born amidst thunder, dark crackling skies, pulsing temples, and armed knights. It's aggressive. It's loud. Then, exactly 10 years later, Elisa is born in the bright spring sun, surrounded by rushing water, described as a fragile, living flower.
A total contrast.
My first thought was that this is just classic elemental pairing the storm and the spring, but the 10-year delay feels so specific. Is there a mechanical reason in the lore for making them a decade apart and giving them such contrasting births?
If we connect this back to the cosmic prologue, it makes perfect sense. It reflects the dual nature of what they are fighting and what they are trying to restore. Koivo represents the storm. He is the kinetic energy, the son of thunder, required to shatter the black stone and break those fiery chains.
He's the weapon.
He is the weapon against the darkness. But you can't just destroy a villain and call the world saved, right? You just have an empty, scarred battlefield. You have to replace the darkness with life.
Oh, I see.
Elisa represents the restorative flora, the water, the spring sun, the white living rose. She is the direct physical link back to the original green foundation of paradise, the Emerald Forest.
Oh, wow. I see it. He is the storm that clears the dead brush, and she is the sun and water that plants the new seeds.
Exactly that. They're the two necessary halves of the Creator's mechanism to reclaim the Earth. As for the 10-year gap, it suggests a necessary developmental timeline. The storm must gestate and mature before the fragile flower can safely bloom in the world.
They need different seasons.
Their union is an alignment of different elemental seasons, orchestrated by a timeline much larger than their own human lives.
So we have the Son of Thunder and the Living Rose alive and breathing on the Earth. And while they are growing up, learning to navigate this world, the cosmic battle against the darkness is silently, violently raging in the background.
The Black Serpent is active.
The world is heavy with this pending judgment. And this leads us directly into what might be the most jarring, intense, and frankly terrifying sequence of the entire text. We shift away from the cosmic overview, we leave the fantasy temples, and we drop straight into the consciousness of a regular, everyday guy named Pastor Kari.
This transition is where the emotional weight of Haltu's world-building truly lands. The text states that temples of the White Hearts around the world began to shine with a bright white light.
A global awakening.
A global spiritual awakening is triggering. But Pastor Kari doesn't experience it as a news headline. He experiences it in an incredibly visceral, localized, and terrifying way. He is sitting in his church, and he is struck by a catastrophic, apocalyptic vision.
It is a full-blown prophetic download, and the imagery here is bloody and overwhelming. Kari looks into the spiritual realm and sees two golden weeping roses, and the tears dropping from these roses aren't water.
No, they are tears of blood.
Beneath these roses is a suffocating, terrifying darkness, filled with reaching hands, souls trapped in absolute despair. The blood drips down, and the exact moment a drop of this blood touches the darkness, the fabric of reality just fractures.
The blood is the catalyst.
Yeah.
The entire cosmic pressure cooker that has been building since the guardian angel was sealed in the black stone thousands of years ago is finally triggered by the bloody tears of these golden roses.
And what happens next is wild.
The text says a golden tsunami-like wave appeared from somewhere. And inside this glittering massive wave, a single word is glowing. Agape.
Let's define agape for anyone unfamiliar. It's an ancient Greek word representing the highest form of unconditional love, the selfless sacrificial love of God. But here in Haltu's text, agape isn't a feeling.
Right, it's not an emotion.
It isn't a warm sentiment or a polite message at the end of a church sermon. It is a literal physical force of nature. It's a weaponized golden tsunami that crashes into the darkness.
That distinction is vital to understanding the magic system here. In this universe, spiritual concepts have literal mass and kinetic energy. Agape is weaponized grace. It sweeps in with devastating, unstoppable force.
It's a physical wave.
The wave hits, and it lifts the golden roses high and simultaneously physically lifts the trapped souls out of the darkness and pulls them up into the brightness of heaven.
And the darkness itself isn't just pushed back. It is physically destroyed. It vanishes into a deep, terrifying ravine, and from within that ravine, Pastor Kari hears demons shrieking in terror.
And what they shout is so incredibly revealing.
Yeah, as they fall, they cry out, "The time of our judgment has arrived."
That single line of dialogue from the demons is the linchpin tying the entire narrative together. Why did they shout about judgment instead of just screaming in pain?
Right, why judgment?
Because this isn't a random spiritual attack. This is the execution of a legal sentence that was handed down at the very beginning of time.
The promise made by the Creator. I will send my son to crush your head, you black serpent.
Precisely. The demons have been living on borrowed time, bound in the realms of the air by those fiery chains, knowing the axe was going to fall eventually. The two golden roses, which clearly represent Toivo and Elisa, our sackcloth-clad witnesses, are the key mechanism for executing that ancient judgment.
Their tears.
Their intense suffering, symbolized by the tears of blood, summons the kinetic force of agape that finalizes the demon's defeat.
So what does this all mean for Kari? He sees the demons judged, the darkness cast out, and the souls rescued. But imagine being the human vessel for that vision.
It would be terrifying.
He wakes up in his pew from this apocalyptic cosmic victory, and he's weeping hysterically. He's completely overwhelmed, crying tears of absolute joy. He is screaming to his completely astonished parishioners who are just sitting there wondering what on earth is happening to their pastor.
They're probably so confused.
He cries out, "It is a revival. A revival is being born." I love this moment because it grounds this massive, galaxy-spanning epic into the raw, messy emotion of a single human being experiencing it.
It brings the cosmic right into the living room. Kyrie's frantic reaction validates the horrifying reality of the spiritual war. It isn't abstract theology to him. It's a literal golden wave that just crashed over his actual soul.
So the darkness is cast into the ravine and the judgment is executed. But destroying a villain doesn't actually heal the world. You have an empty, scarred battlefield. How does the text move from destruction to actual restoration?
That's where we get to the finale.
The deep dive brings us, finally, to the heavenly wedding.
This is the climax of the epic, the moment of ultimate synthesis. In heaven, the Father speaks to the Son, officially initiating the final phase of the plan. He says, "I will bind the hearts of Toivo and Elisa together as one with a golden chain of love. They will be one forever."
The imagery of the chains again.
I want to draw your attention to that specific imagery, yeah? Earlier in the text, the corrupted black stone was bound with burning fiery chains by the fire angel to restrict it. Now, Toivo and Elisa are bound by a golden chain of love.
The chains of imprisonment and restriction versus the chains of chosen union and connection.
It reclaims the very concept of being bound, transforming it from a punishment for rebellion into a promise of eternal partnership. Following this decree, God commands the angels to sing a song of tears and joy.
And the lyrics are important here.
The choir echoes throughout heaven, declaring a deeply profound truth that the tears of Elisa and Toivo, those tears of blood, the intense suffering of the sackcloth witnesses will be gathered into eternal chalices, which will eventually lead to eternal laughter and the final harvest of souls.
I have to pause on that detail. Gathered into eternal chalices. When you usually think of a heavenly realm, the standard trope is that all tears are wiped away, forgotten, erased as if the pain never happened.
Right, wiped clean.
But here, the text is something so subversive, it doesn't erase their suffering. It physically collects it in golden cups and displays it forever. My initial reaction is almost that it's morbid. Why keep the tears of pain in a place defined by eternal laughter and joy? Tell me how to read this.
It's actually the ultimate validation of their earthly struggle. If the tears were simply erased and forgotten, it would imply that their suffering was just a meaningless, temporary glitch in the system, a mistake to be swept under the rug.
Oh, wow.
By gathering the tears into eternal chalices, the Creator is consecrating their pain. It is the universe saying, "Your struggle mattered. Your sorrow was the very currency that purchased this victory."
It honors them.
The tears are sacred enough to be kept forever in the halls of paradise, not as a reminder of sadness, but as the physical trophies of agape. It proves that the darkness they endured was necessary to polish their white hearts.
That is stunning. It sanctifies the trauma rather than just deleting it. And while heaven is singing about these chalices of tears, the narrative camera pans back down to earth for the final physical shot of the epic.
It's a beautiful shot.
And the cinematic framing here is just gorgeous. Picture this. We are on the wooden deck of a ship in a bay. A white wedding dress is fluttering violently in the wind. The angels, the text notes, are blowing to the four winds above the rugged mountains, orchestrating the weather.
Orchestrating the elements.
Suddenly, a gust of wind blows Elisa's veil away, and it drifts up toward the roaring Seven Sisters waterfalls, the exact place she was born as the living rose.
The narrative symmetry in this scene is flawless. The veil falls away, revealing her face. And what is the specific detail the author focuses on? From behind the vanished veil, we see a wide smile and her eyes.
Her eyes.
Dex describes them with incredible precision. Her green, soul-piercing emerald eyes radiated light.
The green gems.
Yes. The entire story began with the Creator breathing light into glowing green emeralds, laying the inorganic foundation of paradise. And the story climaxes with Elisa, looking at Toivo with those same glowing green emerald eyes. She is the physical embodiment, the living, breathing manifestation of the universe's original green foundation, the living, green-eyed bride that the singer angels were prophesying about in their very first song before the earth even existed, has finally physically arrived on the deck of this ship.
It gives me chills every time I read it. She extends her delicate hand and simply says, "I do." Toivo grasps her hand, and the text gives us one final monumental image to close the loop. A diamond on her finger catches the light, and it reflects the radiant rainbow passed by the mist of the Seven Sisters waterfall.
A rainbow through a diamond.
Now, let's tie that back to the very first paragraph of the text. At the dawn of time, the Creator made a green arc shine above paradise, symbolizing the covenant between all future life.
The very first covenant.
Now, thousands of years later, after the fall of the Guardian, the rebellion of the Blackstone, the bloody tears, and the hospital rooms, a physical rainbow is reflecting through a diamond on Elise's hand.
It is the physical manifestation of that ancient cosmic promise. The covenant was never broken by the Black Stone. The light was just waiting to be reflected through the hardened diamond of their union.
And then, the ultimate seal of approval occurs to close the text. Jesus appears on the ship's deck, physically placing his hands over their joined hands, blessing them into an eternal union.
The incomprehensible cosmic scale and the fragile intimate scale are permanently fused together.
Two people holding hands on a boat, blessed by the Creator of the universe. We have covered an almost incomprehensible distance today. We started in the absolute ether with the very breath of God lighting up cosmic emeralds.
The motherboard.
We watched a giant guardian angel fall prey to his own pride, sealed in a black anti-emerald wrapped in fiery chains. We felt the thunder cracking over a modern Finnish hospital room, and we sat in the terrified pews with Pastor Kari as a golden tsunami of weaponized agape obliterated the ancient darkness.
And we ended up on a serene ship deck,
where a son of thunder and a living rose are bound by a golden chain of love.
It is an absolute masterclass in layered world building.
Yeah.
But it's more than just a grand fantasy exercise.
Mm.
The way Topi Haltu constructs this mythos asks the reader to seriously reconsider the scale and purpose of our own lives.
That is the ultimate takeaway. Whether you are looking at this as a brilliant piece of intense high fantasy world building or treating it as a deeply layered spiritual allegory, it reminds you of the immense gravity-defying power of storytelling.
Absolutely.
It shows how the massive, terrifying, incomprehensible scale of the universe can be distilled down into the simple, deeply human act of two people choosing to hold hands and saying, "I do."
If we leave the listener with one lingering thought from this incredibly dense text, it has to be the paradox hidden in that very first angelic song.
Oh, the song about the bride.
Remember, the white-clad singer angels were singing about the green-eyed bride before the earth was formed, before the guardian rebelled, before the black stone fell to earth.
And that is the ultimate challenge for you, the listener, to mull over as we sign off today. If the end of the story, the ultimate triumphant union of Toivo and Elisa, the green-eyed bride, was already written into the very first song ever sung in the Emerald Forest.
And maybe.
Then the entire rebellion, the terrifying black stone, the shrieking demons, and the painful earthly battles weren't a disruption of the Creator's plan. They were the plan.
That's how we thought.
It asks you to look at the chaos in any grand narrative, and maybe even the friction in your own life, and wonder, is the struggle just random, meaningless noise? Or is it the exact, meticulously calculated friction required to polish the diamond?
A profound thought to end on. The darkness only ever served to brighten the white hearts.
I couldn't have summarized it better myself. Thank you so much for joining us on this massive deep dive through the incredible lore of Toivo and Elisa. Keep wondering, keep exploring the narratives around you, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.